This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is March 1st, the year 2000. I'm at the home of Mary Ellen Roach Higgins, and Agatha is not with us today. I'll be interviewing her separately, and Mary Ellen and I are going to talk primarily about her activities or her interests after her retirement from the school. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about, was it your costume class, the growth and size of that?
That one certainly had a great growth, because when the first year I taught it, my first year at the University of Wisconsin in 1960-61, I probably had under 10 students. By the time that I retired, they filled a whole auditorium. maybe it was 60 students. Maybe I might have got up as high as 90. There's a possibility. But much of this probably happened after the school went into the divisional committees, and then our courses could be recognized as really being part of, in my case, social science.
Oh, okay.
And so it could be a social science requirement or simply an elective.
Pick up credits for it.
Pick up credits.
Okay, that would certainly.
And this happened throughout the school.
Yeah.
But in my case, I could see it much more clearly.
Yeah, that's interesting. And significant jump in enrollment, right, like you said, for the school and personally. Great, I wanted to get that on record. Okay, let's talk about your activities after you retired.
Well, in some ways, I really need to talk a little bit about why I retired and retired a few years earlier than I might have.
Okay.
I probably would have waited until about 1966 at the usual retirement age of 65. Instead, I retired in 1984 because of the physical problem I had after I fell from the stage in Washington, D.C. So there were certain things that I count as losses to me in my career, and then in my better moments, which I would go into a little bit later, I see some ways in which I possibly did recoup some of my losses along the way.
Okay.
And one of my losses was that I never wrote the book that I really wanted to write.
Well, now you had written a book with, co-authored a book with Miss Eicher from Minnesota. The name of that was again?
Well, we did two. The first one was a book of readings, Dress a Dorm and the Social Order. The second one was The Visible Self.
Mm-hmm.
And then a third book was part of a National Endowment for the Humanities project that was obtained by Saul Schur. And Saul was someone who, along with his wife, had been long associated with home economics. And they were associated with some magazines that were published in New York City. And somehow these touched down with home economics. And he got this project going and got it funded. And he enticed me when I was in Washington, D.C. that year and into helping with the project and doing some of the writing on it, which I started doing, I agreed, in the fall of 1977. I saw that I was going to be very, very busy, and one of my PhD students, she was Kathleen Ely, had married. She was living in Milwaukee, and she had, during at least one of my leaves, had taken my classes and taught them.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that she and her husband needed money. So I said to Saul, do you really want to get this done? I think we can if we hire on Kathleen Ely. Her last name was Musa at this time. And so she came from Milwaukee here about every week, and we worked together at this table that we are sitting at.
Very same
and
table,
let me say that I really regret that I have not had people that have worked at this table with me carve their initials in it. And it's a very interesting table that I think is worth a little comment. It looks like it might be an ordinary dining room table. It is not. It folds up until it's a little table that you can lean against the wall, and it's only about 14 inches wide. Mm-hmm. But many students have sat with me, or co-workers have sat with me, and now you are sitting mm-hmm. with me at this table. And so it's an important part of my life. But going back to my disappointments, I think I recoup my losses a little bit on that, and I will elaborate that a little bit further. One that I really could not quite recoup was my appointment as coordinator of research at the experiment station, which was in place by the fall of 1980. It was in a relationship, of course, with the College of Agriculture, and the person I was working most closely with was Bob Bray.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
Who was head of the experiment station. So he was one of the two people I probably knew best in the College of Agriculture, the other one being Glenn Pound. But Glenn Pound and Bob Bray were good supporters of me, and I'm sure they were ones that were helping support my appointment to the year in Washington, D.C. And of course I give credit also to Elizabeth Simpson. I'm sure that she was the first one to suggest me, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. she got good cooperation in the appointment from Bob Bray and Glenn Pound. So that one was a little hard to lose. I was just poised to do this, and I had been coming in with to administrative duties with Elizabeth Simpson, and this was sort of her administrative way. This was her kind of operation. She had several faculty who were doing different tasks, and these people reported to her. Rather than having one assistant dean, she had a number of people who were doing assisting mm-hmm. of the dean. Mm-hmm. And it was just her way of operating as an administrator.
Was it an effective way?
Yes, it worked extremely well. And to my surprise, I note that I did, and I think I've already mentioned this, continue as her representative to the North Central Regional Administrators Meeting from Home Economics Units, by whatever name mm-hmm. they were called. Mm-hmm. And I did continue to go to those. But this one with the coordination with the College of Agriculture, it was all in place. I have my letters when I'm saying now in the summer of 1980, we've got these kind of things settled. And then I could not carry on with that one. Another one of my disappointments was my being unable to go to Nigeria an examination that was called, I was called an outside examiner. Mm. It's kind of a British way of universities in other countries that were once part of the so-called British Empire.
Right.
And so they have continued, or at least in the 80s, they were still continuing having an outside examiner for the level of PhD. So I was invited to be the outside examiner for the PhD of Hannah Kaka, who had got her master's degree from me right here mm-hmm. in Madison. So I knew her well. And she was doing this work toward a PhD at a university in Enugu, Nigeria. And I was asked, I believe as early as 1981, but the time went on and the appointment had to go through various channels, and eventually the time was set for 1983. And because, as far as I knew, I was going to get all well and not have fibromyalgia anymore, I did not retreat from this appointment. And my sister even offered to go with me. So well, that nice. There would be two of us to handle luggage, perhaps,
right.
along
yeah.
the way.
Well, concerned
and
about it.
I got my ticket sent to me by the Nigerian, some unit of the Nigerian government, so that I could go there and be the outside examiner. And my husband, Tom, looked at me and said, Mary Ellen, or he called me Mary, Mary, you are not able to go. And I said, Tom, you are right. Hmm. So I did not go. Now, I did get some retrieval on this, because an arrangement was made where I could be outside examiner for Hanna Kaka in Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, there you go. Distance learning, I think they call it now.
Perhaps.
Like that.
Now, the head of the department where she was doing her graduate work toward this advanced degree was actually an Asian Indian who had residence, though, in Canada. And so she was happy to come along with Hanna for this examination in Madison, Wisconsin, because it was also close to where she had family mm-hmm. living in Canada. So the two of them came here, and I had Hanna's thesis that I could read and look at. And with her, she brought something that if you turn to your right, you will see something hanging on the wall, which was a gift. Now, foreign students bring gifts. Mm-hmm. They come bearing gifts. Mm-hmm. And in this room here, we have gifts for foreign
gifts,
students.
Yes.
And that is one of them.
Now, you're talking about the large tapestry.
Very large textile.
Textile.
That could only hang in a home where there are vaulted ceilings,
yeah, it's
because
huge.
It's so large.
It's huge. What is it, about 12 feet high or something?
At least, at least 12. And it looks like it's about 8 feet across,
something
maybe.
Something like seven, eight.
About 7 or 8. And I ask where this, you know, what ethnic group it might be from. And it was not really from Nigeria. It was from Niger, which is to the north. Hmm. A landlocked country that's sort of partly in the Sahara Desert. And I asked her, what do you use these for in Nigeria? And she said, we cut them up and make cushion covers out of them. And then there was one more gift. There was one more gift that came a year or so later, and it was brought by her niece, Mary Anfani Jo, and that is hanging on another wall. Hmm. It is a batik that depicts a kind of ceremony in Nigeria, and it was done by Hanna's nephew, and is extremely unique.
Yes, sir. Quite
and
striking.
It was made for me specially.
Oh,
so
really? Oh, that's beautiful. That's
I really feel
nice.
It.
Yeah.
That was very nice.
Well, they adorn both ends of your room here, kind of bookends to your...
Yes, they are.
Quite striking.
So there was sort of a trade-off here that it wasn't quite so bad that I did not get to use that ticket to Nigeria. And I think those are probably the losses that I... felt. And I have already said, you know, that it was a disappointment that I could no longer participate in departmental and school events to the same degree that I had before.
Let me, before you get into your next section, let me just ask you one question. You were talking before about going to meetings and people from home ec or whatever their disciplines were called. You were going through lots of name changes here, finally arriving at human ecology. Was the same thing happening in other home ec schools throughout the country, essentially?
Yes.
Why? Just trying to kind of modernize?
I believe that part of the effort was to dissociate the programs from being completely for women.
Okay.
That there were programs that were equally appropriate for men as well as for women students. Probably there was pressure from presidents and of universities, mm-hmm. and especially from the land-grant colleges. The administrators from land-grant colleges have their annual meetings in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and at the same time, there are meetings of the deans of colleges of agriculture and deans of whatever home economics units are called these days. So there are those kinds of administrators have their meetings at the same time that chancellors and presidents from the land grants have their meetings. I know a little bit about this because I attended one of them the year I was in Washington, D.C. So I saw Edmund Young there, as I remember. And that was because he was the chancellor here. I believe that would be the right time for his having that
probably
that position. Yeah. I rather think so.
Okay, you can go on.
So
it's just curious because it would seem to me that it would be going on in other schools too, but I wasn't sure.
Definitely, and there has not been changes that have been consistent. I believe that we might have changed the name here to human ecology if the timing had been, way back in 1968, if the timing had been different. In 1968, not only was there a student movement, there was an ecological movement mm-hmm. in the country.
Yes,
and the name ecology was being taken over by many groups. The Silent Spring, yes,
yeah,
that came.
That was right around 60s, early 60s, I think.
Silent Spring.
I think it was 64, something like that.
The Silent Spring, I believe, went back to the 50s.
Did it? Okay. Well,
I sort of remembered from Connecticut or Rhode Island.
Could be, yeah.
Being something that we were commenting on and everybody was reading it.
And that
Rachel
kind of
Carson,
kicked off Rachel Carson's wonderful book. Yeah, that kind of kicked off that whole...
It was well in bloom on this campus, and there were groups that were sort of appropriating that word ecology into their programs, and so it was just not available at that time. And it might have been a very simple kind of change, and a quite appropriate change. And you can see that we used environment when we chose a name for the program area, environment and design. And I believe it was I who dug in my toes one more time and said, we've got to get the apparel dress element in there in some way. And probably no public ever saw that apparel or dress might be included under environment.
Under environment.
But I felt comfortable there.
I can see it,
Because I know if you got to what dress might be, it could be a physical environment for a person. It could be an interface between the individual and the environment. But so that would be the biological human being. But the other... The rest of a definition of dress has to be that it's also a communicative symbol.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and I'm saying because these are the kinds of ideas that I worked with through time, and my hard work in trying to get rid of what were called the functions of dress. Mm-hmm. It is protection and ornament. Mm-hmm. It is protection and ornament. Or you might get thrown in with it, those two, modesty. Mm-hmm. The functions of dress are to protect and to ornament and to make one modest in one's environment. And I looked at those terms, I knew they were all valuing terms. Mm-hmm. You know, you're supposed to protect human bodies. Mm-hmm. Okay, but clothes, if you want to use that term, can be non-protectors of the body. If you expand it to dress, all of many of the kinds of piercing of the body mm-hmm. and so forth are not necessarily helpful. They're not exactly protecting of the body. And so these were obsolete terms that that through time, I know I'm really getting into what I did after retirement. I had my time available to use as I wanted to use it, and as I had the energy to use it. So when I had the energy to do something, I could go out and do my search through the literature on dress. And that's my best term. No terms are good to describe the area that I was associated. Dress perhaps is the best because it includes not only those things that are attached to the body in some ways or carried by the body in some ways, but they also, the term can be used to include changes in the body itself, like pierced ears, body paint,
tattoos,
all those kinds of things. So the word dress is can be used as a very inclusive term. It does not bring in the valuing that clothing does, because clothing is saying you're somehow protecting the body, that word does. And then ornament is another valuing term, because who's going to say what is beautiful and not beautiful, handsome or not handsome, attractive or not attractive? These are valuing terms. And so what I've said to you already, if you think of dress having these kind of functions, that is, as an environment or interface with environment, or as something that will communicate, that doesn't say it's communicating that something beautiful or something is ugly. These are terms that you can use without a value, a valuing of dress. So you can be rather objective in your study. Now, with those kinds of definitions in mind, and I must say that these have been arrived at through a considerable length of time by Joanne Eicher and myself.
And yourself, right.
And we kept working with our definitions so we could get to some that were really objective and could be submitted to research, if you will. Now, what I wanted to do after I retired was to find out where these valuing terms came from and why they were seen as so sacred. And I picked out a point in time that I saw them being really stressed in literature that had to do with dress. And the time date, the time was about 1930. And there was a spate of books or chapters in the books that were talking about ornament versus protection, ornament versus protection, ornament versus protection. And two of them were named, one of them, there were two that even had psychology in their titles. One was the psychology of clothes, one was the psychology of dress. And the psychology of clothes was done by an Englishman named Flugel. And when I looked through it, I knew that I was reading that he was referring to Freudian psychology, psychoanalytic theory. And knowing this, I'm quite certain of this, I collected a group of books, and I began to chart out what they were saying for the functions of dress. I got rather a long list of them. I think I had I began to see certain themes that were going through them. But I want to leave that idea and come back to it, to a broader kind of study that I was led into. When I began to look at these books and chapters, like by psychologists, by sociologists, by popular historians, by historians, and by people, I did say psychologists, sociologists. There were many of them, and they were, here were these books being published with this, you know, the functions of dress are, the functions of dress are. And I begin to see also two other terms that got related, and that was Charles Darwin and a piece of cloth. A piece of, well, it depended on whether you read his journal of the ship Beagle mm-hmm. around the world, or whether you read his later book on the voyage of the Beagle, in which he edited what was in his journal. And I thought, Charles Darwin, that piece of red cloth, that piece of red cloth, why do they keep bringing that up as an illustration? So that got me into the 19th century. Essentially, in mid-century, I believe The Origin of Species came out in 1848. At the same time, Herbert Spencer was doing with the sociology, because he did a set of books on sociology, and in this there is a rather interesting section which is on dress. And Herbert Spencer is the one that Darwin, in his Origin of Species, gives credit for, this phrase, survival of the fittest. Mm-hmm. All right. So one of the things I was doing when I was looking at the books, I not only went to Memorial Library and looked at books, I also went to Steinbach, where the books for home economics mm-hmm. were. And so there were quite a few interesting books there. And I might say that I seem to start that in 1985, and in retrospect, I know I must have been sitting down when I went through the stacks to find these books, because I could not stand in place. I still do not stand in place well. I have not been able to sit at a desk for 20 years. You might think I'm sitting in this chair right now as if I were sitting at a desk, but I am not. I could not lean over here and work like this were a desk.
Right.
And so I, through time, I've learned not to be a bit embarrassed. If I cannot stand up any longer in one place, like check out in a store, I just sit on the floor. Well, I went to the libraries, and then I thought, I want to find more, I want to find more. And because I like to collect books, I started going to the used bookstores mm-hmm. in town. I probably started with Paul's bookstore mm-hmm. on State Street.
Right.
And I found the complete set of Herbert Spencer's sociology mm-hmm. in pristine shape. And I bought it for $15.
Wow.
I loved it. I've given it away now. And, I want to put this information into this interview, and that is, and I think maybe I have said already, that my library left in 1995 for the University of Minnesota within what they now call human ecology, and specifically within their very well respected Goldstein Gallery, mm-hmm. which is a gallery of I don't want to say practical arts, but arts of the home mm-hmm, and the arts mm-hmm. of dress. And they did not have library materials in these areas. Their library was very small. And so I gave them my library. And I connect to the University of Minnesota through Joanne Iger
right.
and our wanting of our libraries and archives to be together. So the other thing that will happen after I get through talking to Barry is that I will finish the last sorting of my own personal papers, and they will be received into the new archives building
Great.
At the University of Minnesota. I believe I've hit them at a good moment, and that is when they have space.
Yeah. Yeah, archives, you've got to get them early. That space fills up in a hurry. Well, that's very exciting.
I think you know about that archive.
Yeah, I know a little bit about space and archives.
And they are just moving in, and I last talked to a person there toward the beginning of February, and they had not, I thought they were moving in January. They had not yet moved in. And I said, oh, and it sounded like it was going to be much better to send things in March than in February. And the things are in good shape so they can be handled. I put them into archival surroundings if I thought they were pretty valuable. Like when.
Okay.
Too much coffee. That's alrighty. I was talking about my own personal papers. They will be going very soon to the University of Minnesota. And some of my papers are already there. I sent files of material to Joanne Eicher, and I think they are resting in a space outside her office. And some of it includes many more papers on the famous that relate to developments of the social psychology of dress. And I used them. I used them when I did a paper for the International Textile and Apparel Association on the history of the social science of dress through time. And the summer that I worked on that, or maybe it was the year that I worked on it, I made many telephone calls across the country to people who I knew had some information in their heads, or they might have written materials. So I got quite a few written materials from people across the country.
Right.
So there is a good file that Joanne is in charge of that I sent along to her at that time, which should go into the archives that are both hers and mine. But going back now to what I was doing in collecting books, I was finding books that were related to the theories of Darwin and evolution. Mm-hmm. Evolutionary theory in the 19th century and into the 20th century. Now, where did I find it? All right, I found it in Herbert Spencer, who was in the social areas doing evolution of society. And part of the evolution of society was the evolution in dress. Now, lurking in the value terms and lurking in the evolutionist's approach to things is that societies that run around without very many clothes on are probably, well, savages, or at best they might move into being barbarians, unless you find in the literature. Or if you get to people who really cover their bodies, then indeed they are civilized. But there was a total kind of picture. I had Darwin, I had Spencer. And then I realized that I had somebody else. And it was called, the two people really, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. So here we have our economic, political evolution with the Marxists. Somehow poor Engels got left out of the naming of Marxist theory when he was very much a part of it, if you read the introductions to a writing. So maybe the person who sent me a letter and said, when he saw a reference to an article I did on adolescent theory, that I was as red as the red ink that he was writing his letter in, suspected that one of my favorite books, it's really a little pamphlet
more,
is the Communist Manifesto.
Which Mary Ellen has in her possession at this very second.
I'm holding it to my bosom. I lost my first one, and but I went out probably, well, I went to the university bookstore and got a used one for 45 cents to replace it. Now, this is a, you have to think of the, what might happen in the translation from German into English, and, you know, the changes in words that might take. But then you also have to remember that both Marx and Engels spent about 30 or 40 years of their lives living in England after they were exiled from Germany. I think they spent some time in France. I'm not sure they were terribly welcome there. But in my mind, I have a picture of one or both of them sitting in the library at the British Museum. It can't be to do the Communist Manifesto because that's too early. I believe it's about 19 or 1848, I've forgotten. But, you know, very close to the time of the publishing of The Origin of Species. And in this introduction to the version I have here, which I believe was published about 1888, and has, Marx was deceased by that time, and so the introduction is done by Frederick Engels. But in this, he does say that they are looking to Darwin, who did the biological evolution, wrote on the biological evolution, and they are doing, or they are predicting, that they are predicting an evolution in society from, through different stages, and the next stage will be the communist kind of social political scene in which everybody is equal and they will be relieved of the power of the middle classes, mm-hmm. who are exploiting the poorer classes of people. So there is Karl Marx in place along with the evolutionists. And then I got to Sigmund Freud, and his work comes at the end of the 19th century, and some commentators on Freud have said, mistakenly or rightly, that Freud made the mistake of going with the evolutionists when he described the evolution of human personality, of the individual. Mm-hmm. So he did the evolution of the individual psyche, if you wish. We had someone else doing the political economic evolution writing. We had somebody else doing, of course, the biological, and someone mm-hmm. else doing the sociological. Mm-hmm. So when I had all these people together, I thought, oh, I do have a background for looking at this proliferation of books about 1930, but psychoanalytic theory really had its heyday in the 20th century and continued pretty much in its heyday until the 1930s. And then other kinds of psychology began to replace Freud, and we still live with it in everyday life. The psychology of Americans is on an everyday basis is psychoanalytic. Ego is a common word that mm-hmm. we see. I've even seen id, mm-hmm. the it, in advertisements in the New York Times. in probably clothing. Let your id have its day. And this takes me to something else that I discovered. It's a little bit off of the main track here. But one of the things I became interested in, as I looked at the translation of one of Freud's books that came out in the 1920s, and it got named, I'm not absolutely sure of how the words go in the title, but it's the id, it's the ego, superego, and the id. All those words are in the title. I read the introduction to this small booklet, and I collected as much Freud as I could without spending too much money. Much of his writing is in little paperbacks, mm-hmm. and so I had quite a few of them. But in the publication of the id, the ego, superego, and the id, the publishers could not decide at first how they should translate from the German. And in German, those three terms are in everyday German. It's the ich, the super ich, and the SS, which is. And they made the decision not to translate into literal English, which does sound a little awkward. It would be I and over I, or above I, and the it. Now those do not sound nearly as exotic and mysterious as ego, superego, and id. Id, that devil that makes us do things. Yes, that id out there. Just a few years ago at the International Texas Apparel Association, I sought out a young man who'd been coming fairly regularly to these meetings from France. It is indeed an international organization, and I think they might have, they certainly have a number from Korea who come. There have always been Canadians. There are quite a few other countries that now send representatives to that organization. But I found my young Frenchman, and I said, please tell me how the German words got translated into French. He happened to be somebody whose first tongue was probably German, because he grew up in one of the Alsace-Lorraine, or one of the other border kinds of states in France. But the words were translated into everyday French. Hmm. They were not translated into the Latin, which has a mysterious sound to it. It's sort of like what happened with medicine for many, many years. I think the doctors even wrote prescriptions in Latin. Well, in French, they were moi, a la Miss Piggy, moi, sur moi, on I, and ça, that, over there.
Interesting.
So this made me happy to learn what was happening with the translations. And I think that it had added to the mystique of psychoanalytic theory. Certainly in the United States.
A little cat crawling into my bag here. There we go.
Yes, the cats really like anything that's open.
Yes, I just discovered that.
And you also are on her chair over there, which helps her to climb up to the railing. Okay. So you are most interesting. All right, where was I? I was on Freudian theory, and it's our everyday kind of theory.
In the 1930s, there was.
In the 1930s. And so I believe that that was a big influence on what was being written in the psychology of dress, at the same time that evolutionary theory mm-hmm. in general, the social evolutionary theory, had passed on, and we were going to other kinds of theories of social theories, mm-hmm. and evolution was passé in economic fields, pretty much. Not completely, okay. We have our communist, I shouldn't say that. Social evolution, I believe, yes. But anyway, and we did continue on. Well, this helped me then to understand why I was finding this these functions of dress, mm-hmm. which were really passé with evolutionary theory.
Mm, interesting.
Were popping up in theories of dress and appearance, because they were hanging on, as Freudian theory was hanging on in psychology. And well, once I knew that, I was sort of set free.
Yeah, once you can free yourself from the past, then you can look at
then I can look at, and what we moved
sort of
into
macro,
then
yeah.
Was symbolic interaction theory, uh-huh. If you want the social psychological side of it. And you could then you could also look at form, and you could talk about the cultural too. And so these were much easier approaches to do as looking at its symbolism.
So you had to take this backward journey.
I had to take
you
this
had to go back to,
for my
to,
own personal satisfaction.
To where so much of modern scholarship seems to reside back in the Darwinian
Spencer. In the 19th century, yeah. I had to get back there. Right. And I had this great need, and I had the just enough energy and interest. I loved it. Now, something else happened in my life about 1985, and that is I bought my first computer.
Ah.
So I was ready.
Not too long after the first ones on campus came,
the personal
ones in the early 80s,
I got my first Macintosh in January of 1985. Hmm. And that's when I started going out and using whatever energy I had to gather up my mm-hmm. books. And I loved to be able to buy them and put them in with my other books. So I had a very good cross-section of the theories of evolution. I'm afraid my poor Voyage of the Beagle by Charles Darwin is not in very
really,
good shape.
It looks like it's been on several voyages of its own there.
Yes. And what's amazing is that this ship, which went out to do surveying for the British government, the ship Beagle, they were doing surveying, and when you do surveying, you probably are working toward making up maps that are more accurate. I don't know for sure.
I would think so.
I looked in my old Encyclopedia Britannica, but it did not help me on that. Well, when I get to the Voyage of the Beagle, it connects with these books that were turning out protection versus ornament versus mm-hmm. modesty and immodesty and so forth, because I ran across what I call the tiresome twosome. And in many of these books, which in turn were used as references by books that succeeded them up to the 90s. I kept finding Darwin and a piece of cloth. Mm-hmm. It was associated with the visit of the people on the ship Beagle when they visited in Tierra del Fuego, at the base of South America. And most of these books had no reference in the footnotes that they played. These people just knew that Charles Darwin, he was the naturalist on this tour, which took 5 years. He was the naturalist age about 23 when the voyage began. Surveyed both sides of South America and then quite a bit in the Pacific Ocean. They got to New Zealand, they got to Australia, they got to Tasmania, all these places. And I have even used a chapter out of the Beagle as a class reading at times. And so I've had my copy of Voyage of the Beagle for a long, long time. And I began to find, this piece of cloth and the and Darwin, and I began to have some fun with it. And I believe it was 1986, because I was reading this material, and Joanne and Iker and I would get together on things. And so we decided that I would write up a couple of proposals for papers to be presented at our International Textile and Apparel Association meeting. It was going to be in Houston, Texas. And by 1986, two things had happened in a very positive way for me. One of them was that I had new medication that allowed me more good time. Mm-hmm. And I found a foldable chair made in England called a Gadaba. And I could carry it with me anywhere I went and knew that I would have a place to sit. Mm-hmm. And I could sit in airplane seats. I can sit in cross-country bus seats. I'm very comfortable. And if all else fails, I'm going to move into a movie theater because I can sit in movie theater seats. But anyway, I had my chair and I could travel. I could put it up in the bins over the seats in the airplane, and off I could go. And eventually I made one trip to England with Joanne to a seminar in Oxford. But this had happened, and at this particular time, 1986 then, I had been reading for about a year. And so I wrote up two proposals to send in for presentations at the annual meeting of ITAA. And one of them was called Evolutionary Myths and Miasma. And the other one was Darwin and the Cloth. Because I kept finding Darwin and the Cloth in these books. it was just a kind of given. Mm-hmm. And so we sent them in. I wrote up both of them, and you know, if both of them had gone through, each of us would have had a paper we would have given. Well, our Darwin and the Cloth got turned down.
Oh.
It got turned down. And it was for not a very good reason. It appeared that the people who were the readers thought that we might be making rather personal remarks about some of our colleagues who might have used Darwin in a way that we would satirize. Mm-hmm. It was not a good reason. I believe that we would have been circumspect and not have done this. As a matter of fact, we didn't have to do this. We didn't have to do this. We had plenty of examples that were not this. So part of my fun, after a few years, let's see, that was 86. Mm-hmm. And I did have some honors along the way that were coming from my International Textiles and Apparel Association. I was made a fellow, and then perhaps given the highest award that the outfit can give, which was a lecture award in 1993. And it had a peculiar name at that time. There was a small money prize that went with it. And it changes it, but it was the lecture award. And so you were expected to give a lecture. So Joanne Eicher said to me, Why don't you do Darwin and the Cloth?
Finally, it hatches.
And there were two people in my life that I often told they were just alike. And that was my husband, Tom, and Joanne Eicher, who was also a very good friend of Tom. Mm-hmm. And I said they were just alike because they were always full of suggestions of things I could do, professional things I could do. And then I would add, I will listen, and I know I will listen, because they had some awfully good ideas and I could pick and choose among them as I jolly well felt. Mm-hmm. And I took her idea, Darwin the Cloth, how wonderful, how wonderful. And so I spun my little story. And I had as kind of one of the takeoffs in it was to go back to a book that you said you had read.
Yeah, Jacques Barzan.
Jacques Barzan's Teacher in America.
Yeah. It was still being used in the mid-70s as a...
Well, I was using it in the 50s, and I believe it was originally published in the 40s.
Nice, great book.
And there were two chapter names that I just adored, and they were How to Read and Be Right, and How to Write and Be Read. Mm. And there were quite a few other sayings I could go back to. Another one was, you didn't, it was equivalent to, you don't have to believe the printed word. It may be just hokum. You don't have to believe that printed word at all.
There you go.
And I realized when I went back to it that I did not realize in my first time around on reading it. And that was that he was a bit sexist. Hmm. He said you the women were harder to teach in college than men, but you could do it. Hmm. If you just use the right techniques. Well, I didn't use that in my talk that I gave on Darwin and the cloth. I did not use that. But I did how to read and be right, and how to write and be read were just wonderful. And so I used those. I used some other ideas that I spun into my tale. And then, following up on his how to read and be right and how to write and be read correctly, I might add, was not to trust that printed word. And I had found this tiresome twosome of Darwin and the cloth. And I'd made my charting out of these. Now, what did Flugel say? What did Herlock say? What did W.I. Thomas say back? He was an early psychologist. He was back to the turn of the century. No. And there was a historian in this group, and I just kept going on and on. So I found approximately 14 references to him from all of these fields, you know, sociology, psychology, history, popular writing, and then the ones that were supposed to be the psychology of dress. And then I started comparing what they wrote. And following up with, you know, just don't trust that written word that you're getting. Well, I looked at it, and I hope that I could reach for something here which might be make me a little bit more accurate in what I say. Out of these, you know, 10 to 15 that I had collected, they began to repeat each other. And of course, they referenced each other rather than, than anything by Darwin.
Right.
I don't think there was an actual reference to Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle in any of them. And so here are some of the things that I found. And these were the kind of givens. The Fuegians in Tierra del Fuego, I think Tierra del Fuego in Spanish means land of the fires. I think that they built fires to keep warm because obviously they were savages. They didn't cover their bodies hardly at all, and yet they survived here at the tip of South America, which leads me off on another little tangent. That is that, and I shared this with him, I couldn't put it in print, there's one historian, I believe she was a historian of costume, that said, was making a statement about the history of costume, and she said, from Tierra del Fuego to Patagonia. I thought, Tierra del Fuego to Patagonia? You can look from the island of Tierra del Fuego and see the coast of Patagonia. And Darwin even called Tierra del Fuego Foot Patagonia. Well, that's another example. Do not trust the printed word. Do not trust it. But anyhow, when looking at these examples I had, I cut them down to about 7. And I even had a couple of versions of Darwin. I had what was probably exactly from his journal that he kept during these 5 years, and the other was in a book published on the voyage of the Beagle. I think its first publication was about 1848. I'm not real sure of that. Well, here, I have it. 1839 and 1845, he already had these out. But, so we have Darwin. There are other people on the ship Beagle. I presume they were all men. And we have these Fuegians who are living there. And we have the meeting of the English that were on the ship with the Fuegians. Well, I looked at my examples here, and I raised various questions. One of them was, who gave cloth to the Fuegians? Mm. Darwin says, we gave cloth. Mm. Now, every one of my, I think every one of the 14 said, Darwin gave cloth to the Fuegians. There was a little change taking place. There was evolution that could be perceived here, and I did do it in my talk. I gave them the evolution of what Darwin had actually written. Mm-hmm. And these mm-hmm. various writers who quoted him but didn't...
They really created an evolution of what Darwin said.
Yes. So it reduced it, the group, the we, to one person who was giving cloth, and that one person was named as Darwin mm-hmm. every time. And he said, we gave them cloth. And two of the authors added size to this piece of cloth. One called it large, and one called it good size. Mm. And the treatment of the cloth by the Fuegians differed. Some of them said they placed it on the body. Some of them said they tied it someplace. Some said they took it and tore it into pieces, or they cut it into pieces, that they distributed among themselves. And what was particularly funny to me was how they used this cloth in relationship to their bodies. Now, Darwin was quite consistent. He said they tied it around their necks. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't one Fuegian, it was mm-hmm. more than one. And necks are not mentioned in any of those evolving descriptions of what happened to a piece of cloth when Darwin was present in Tierra del Fuego. It was not tied to necks. That's what Darwin said. Instead, it got tied to legs, and then one woman said limbs. It was tied to limbs. And then one of the writers said it was tied to arms and legs. Hmm. No one mentioned necks. So I use this as a little description how you could see evolution taking place in a text. And I had great fun in doing this talk. And when I got to the end, I said, and I had used, of course, Jacques Bergson mm-hmm. a great deal. And I said, he didn't tell me everything. He didn't guide me in everything. He guided me to take a very critical look at these books, mm-hmm. yes. But there was one of my colleagues in the Foods and Nutrition Department called Dorothy Pringle. And she is still in town. She's retired. And Dorothy dropped into my office one day, and I was sitting there looking a little glum, perhaps, and had in my hands my rejection of some paper that I'd sent in mm-hmm. for possibly being published. And it had been returned to me, it had been rejected. And Dorothy laughed and said, we all get those. We just stand in the corner for a minute, and then we go back and rewrite them and send them in. They get published. And so then I said, this is my rewrite of my rejected Darwin and the Cloth. So I really had great fun in giving this paper.
Well, it's sort of a metaphor for home economics, too. I mean, it's the whole thing, the evolutionary changes and the...
Yes,
the,
it has evolved. It has evolved.
And but, the ball starts,
But I believe that... Well, there were two other things that happened at that same meeting. It was 1993. It was kind of my, my valedictory. Mm-hmm. It was really the last presentation that I gave, and
well,
I
that's a great did. Way to go out. In a sense, you finally gave your Cloth.
And that same year, one of my graduate students had a student who had done a study of the two research journals that we might publish in from Textiles and Clothing or Home Economics, and so this student had gone through all of the journals of home economics and all the journals of our journal that goes with ITAA. And I got my name at the top as the most referenced. Yeah. Now, wasn't that kind of nice?
That's great. It's like a citation index. That's very important. It was a citation index.
So that was sort of nice. But I believe that the highest point
in my career
occurred at the same meeting when I was sitting talking with a group. We were sort of in the hallway of the hotel where we were meeting in, I believe, Minneapolis. And going by was one of my friend Joanne Eicher's students, PhD students, who by this time was teaching in some university or other. But she was always rather interesting because she liked to wear hats. Now, I wear hats and turbans because I am losing my hair, but that was not the reason that this person wore her. She liked to wear them, and they were usually little sort of small derbies. Well, she was really kind of a delight to those through the years, and I had known her for quite a while, and I knew that she was kind of a little eccentric, perhaps, but still great. But she walked by and looked over at me. This was after I had given my presentation and said, I didn't know you were funny. That's the climax of my career. I rest my case.
Well, I want to point, one thing I didn't point out before is I'm sitting at Mary Ellen's table, this table that has been through so much and had so many different people sitting around it throughout the course of Mary Ellen's career. And I think I'm getting a little bit of your operational style. Every time I come in here, you have, today we have Darwin's book, we have the Communist Manifesto, we have Jacques Barzun's book, we have several magazines out. We have the different citation things. We have two folders that are opened and earmarked to other places. We have a blank pad, and we have probably a half dozen pens of different colors and shades and hues. We have glasses, and we have a Kleenex. And that's just on her end of the table, and a glass of water. So there are always many things going on, I think, at this table, and I'm sure there were throughout the course of your career. I think on... do you have anything else you'd like to add?
I'd like to talk a little bit about my graduate students.
Go right ahead.
And I hope that I can sort of move. I had them right in front of me.
There you are.
Now, we've talked a little bit about Hannah Kaka, and that she is with us. Now, you will see over there a brass plate on the wall.
Yes, I do.
That's from Jin-Gu Kim, from Korea, who did her master's and PhD with me, and whom I met up with again at ITAA meetings about 4 or 5 years ago. And I learned about her career back in Korea, which I did not know about before then. She had been turning out PhD students. many of them. And through her, she did a historical work on costume in Korea. Through her, I learned a great deal about Korea, and I knew that there are a number of universities, but almost all of them are in Seoul. They're almost, and where the greater part of the population is. But she had PhD students in any number of these universities in Seoul. So when I got home, I found somebody who could help me to bring together her paper so we could recommend her for an alumni award from the school, which we did. Karen Goebel had the facilities of the school, and she could do faxing to Korea, and so she could get the recommendations. So we had Jin-Gu Kim. I think maybe I will tell you another little story associated with my meeting up with her again. The first time was in Pasadena. It was in Pasadena. And when I go to meetings these days, I go to meeting, if I feel like if I don't want to go to a meeting at this moment, I may go sit on the patio, which I can do in Pasadena. But anyway, someone got to me at this meeting. It said, Jin-Gu Kim is here. And they took me out to try to find her. Finally, I couldn't find her, but I sat down in a chair by one of the book company's display, and somebody found Jin-Gu for me. And she had one of her students, former PhD students, with her. And events went ahead, and there was a point in time where she was going up, getting on an elevator and going upstairs to her room. And I was deciding, I'm going out and sit on the patio. But she put something in my hand, an envelope. It was an envelope of the hotel. And she said, here is a love letter. Hmm. I did not know what a love letter was. So I said, thank you. And I went out to sit in the nice sun of the patio of the hotel in Pasadena. So I opened up the envelope, and it had five $100 bills in it.
Oh my goodness.
And I saw somebody I knew, Bob, last name I can't remember right now, but I associate him with Nebraska and Ohio State and a few other places. I went over to Bob and I said, do you see what I think I see? Well, I learned subsequently that it was part of a kind of custom in Korea, because somebody I knew left that meeting and went to Korea and met with possibly someone who had been her student. And so she went to the home of the mother of the student and the home of the grandmother. And when the girl would leave, she would have love letters. Mm. And Marilyn DeLong, who's the one from Minnesota who was visiting, said they had money in them. It was not small amounts of money.
Wow.
So it was a kind of custom, which made it make some sense to me.
Nice custom.
It was sort of unbelievable. But anyway, she did extremely well. And really a go-getter, what she'd done in Korea. And I had no idea of this until I began to meet these Koreans who had been her students, and they were coming to these meetings of ITAA. Let's see, I had my first graduate was Kathleen Elin, now Kathleen Campbell, and she taught in several universities. Her first husband was working on a degree in medicine, and somehow she was packing up about every year to move places. And she's the one who did the New Perspectives on the History of Western Dress, which is one of my favorite publications.
And that's nice.
Along with the Dress Adornment of the Social Order, which was a first in the field. It was a first textbook, so that was nice. Mm. I got dubbed as pioneer for that by people in Ohio. Getting back to my students, and I was on Kathleen. Kathleen eventually, with her husband, her name was now Campbell, was they ran a market research business out of Minneapolis. Hmm. And they did research for retailers across the country. And had extremely great success in their business. They've now retired. Hmm. They're not quite to their mid-50s yet. But they have retired, and so they moved back and forth between the Twin Cities and Arizona, mm-hmm. where I think they also yes. have a part-time in Florida and those kinds of things. Then one of my students, Barbara Taylor, was the president of the American Home Economics Association. Mm-hmm. Another one, that was Barbara Taylor, Hilda Buckley's on the faculty at the University of Illinois. And I have Sue Dodson is at a university in Tennessee. We'll come back to Ruth Morrissey in a minute, okay. because we didn't talk about her relationship to the Helen Allen Collection. No. Kim Johnson is on the faculty at Minnesota with Joanne. And Cindy Jasper is on faculty here at Wisconsin. She, in a way, took my place because my two last graduate students were Kim Johnson and Cindy Jasper, and they completed in the summer of 1984. And Charlene Lind, she was a head of a department at Brigham Young University. Let's see, that gets most of my, I have a very interesting master's student, and what she does doesn't exactly connect with anything at all concerned with her master's, but she is a quilt maker who tours the world.
Oh, wow.
Teaching classes in quilt making. She's published about 5 books.
Wow.
And she's been in Denmark, there's a few places I remember. She's been in Australia teaching. She's been in South Africa and all across the United States and Canada. She has been going. She's a master's student, but an interesting one.
I noticed that most of the students that you've named have gone into academia.
We need them.
Direction that they would.
That would be the obvious direction,
right?
And Kathleen was in Chicago when she moved into the realm of market research, and she got a job at the department store Carson Peary Scott.
Yeah.
She had taught at several universities. But she got a job there, Carson Peary Scott, and she did market research for them, and later she did this with a husband, and they did extremely well in their travels across this country. But anyway, the students have done interesting things, and they have made contributions in their respective ways.
Now, you mentioned Ruth Morrissey.
Oh, Ruth Morrissey. I believe that Ruth finished her degree with me. I believe she started with somebody else who left faculty and was no longer with us.
Okay, go ahead. Ruth Morrissey.
Ruth Morrissey. I believe that she finished with me and had started with somebody else, but it was easy for me to take her over because she was doing a kind of a cultural study of weaving in villages in Guatemala.
Ooh, wow.
And Guatemala isn't always the safest place to be these days, but I think she was there a little bit before things became quite as unsettled as they might be now.
Yeah.
So she made several trips down there. I think maybe one of her daughters went also. So she and I sat here right where I'm sitting right now. And let's see, she finished in 1983. I was not yet very mobile at that time, but I could sit here and work with her. And I was still on faculty then, but I did not spend much time in my office. I bought a very peculiar chair. This is before I found my portable ones that I put in my office, that I could stay there part of the time, but mostly I stayed home to work except when I had classes, because it was impossible to do otherwise.
And she was, Ruth was
Ruth then
curator of,
yes,
of the...
When she finished her degree, she became the curator of the costumes, and she did quite a bit of cataloging of them. And now I guess they're you know, with computers and the web and so forth, they now are at another level, yeah, of catalog. They're going to have, yeah, to recatalog, but she did do quite a bit of work with cataloging, keeping order of the library that came with the textiles from Helen Allen also.
It's just a beautiful collection. Or your current curator, Ms. Fitzgerald,
Marianne Fitzgerald.
Marianne Fitzgerald, I think I mentioned this, gave me a tour.
Yes.
And it was just...
I've had her here to see if there's some textiles here, yeah, that she might like in the collection, yeah, too. And we've never quite got back together to discuss what might happen, particularly some Mexican things. I am ready to move along to somebody else right now. I'm not ready to take things off,
mm-mm,
the walls of my,
oh, no,
living,
this,
room.
This house is so charming. No, I think that...
as I said, graduate students, I started around, didn't quite get all the way. Or there is a juju piece. Joanne brought me that from Nigeria. See the black figures over there?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think I could, that would be very hard for me to give up. One of its charms was that I looked over when I first had it, and there was some sort of sawdust on it. I looked, and not only did I get the juju piece, I got a critter that was living in it.
What is a burrowing bell?
And I got something to spray it with several times to make sure that I had not imported,
that's right,
an insect from Nigeria that I did not need.
You have a lot of nice woodwork here that they might have, their relatives might have really grown very fond of, yes.
So there, but the graduates, working with the graduate students was enjoyable, and I like that. And they have been doing interesting things, and I am pretty much in contact with all of the PhD students that I have had. And I've lost a few of the master's students.
Uh-huh. When I wind down an interview, I always ask the person for their last word, sort of a chance for you to summarize in a few sentences your career at the university. Do you have anything you'd like to say?
I've already given my last word, and that is that I'm funny.
And on that note, we will end the interview. Thank you very much, Mary Ellen.